You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Our guest speaker tonight, Ingrid Betancourt, was born in Bogota and raised in Paris, daughter of Colombia's ambassador to UNESCO. In her parents' apartment in Paris, something of a salon for homesick intelligentsia from South America, she remembers reading poetry with Pablo Neruda. In 2002, as she campaigned for the Colombian presidency, promising an offensive against the narcos, she was kidnapped by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia guerrillas, better known as FARC. She was held in the Colombian jungle for 6.5 years and liberated in 2008. Her deeply moving memoir, Even Silence Has an End, about her time in captivity, was a New York Times and a global bestseller. As The Guardian noted in a glowing review, it is not for the faint-hearted. Her first novel, which we'll speak about tonight, The Blue Line, is set in Argentina in the years before and during its dirty war, and as well in present-day New England. The dirty war in Argentina, the Latin American dictatorship, the New York Times critic who reviewed the book noted about it. I happened to be reading an advanced copy of the book in Buenos Aires as the Argentines were celebrating the inauguration of a new president. In the midst of this joyous demonstration, it was hard to believe that older citizens endured a national event that ranks somewhere below Nazi Germany and Rwanda in the annals of state-run mass murder. Ingrid Betancourt is currently based in London, and she works to draw attention to the plight of hostages and victims of terrorism around the world. In conversation with Ingrid tonight, Alicia Partnoy, an Argentine poet, was one of Argentina's 30,000 disappeared. She was abducted in 1977 from her home by the secret police, separated from her young child, and tortured at a concentration camp called the Little School, where she was one of the few who survived. Her writings were smuggled out of prison and published in human rights journals. Among her many published works is The Little School, Tales of Disappearance and Survival, her memoir of her disappearance and imprisonment in Argentina. The Little School appeared on the London Times bestseller list, and her poetry collection, Flowering Fires, Fuegos Florales, was a Pushcart Foundation Writer's Choice selection. Her work's been translated into several languages, and she's the recipient of the first Settlement House American Poetry Prize. She teaches here in town at Loyola Marymount. Please welcome our two distinguished guests tonight. We'll begin with a reading by Ingrid Betancourt. Thank you.
I would like to apologize for my English. I'll have to read in English, but okay. Julie is happy. She tugs impatiently at the lock on the frame and forces the window open. Leaning out, she allows the vagabond wind to sweep in and fill her entire being. She closes her eyes. She recognizes that salty, tarry smell. This Connecticut wind is strangely similar to the wind of her Buenos Aires childhood. It's not as intense, perhaps, lighter, more delicate, or perhaps not. She knows from experience that memory can be misleading. The present often seems less vibrant than our recollections of the past. She smiles. She likes the restraint of her surroundings, the neatly clipped shrubs in the gardens across the way, the carefully aligned elms along the avenue that runs perpendicular to the beach, the hedge and the grass that frame the fine sand, like a rampart stretching parallel to the waves, and the horizon, a straight blue line drawn from one end to the other. It suits her, this symmetry. She has finished putting her life in order. She is in her rightful place, living the destiny she has chosen for herself, with the man she has always loved. She looks up at the azure sky above her maple tree. Happiness is blue. Blue horizon, blue water. A Mark Rothko painting, she thinks, framing the sky with her fingers. She'd like to hang that painting just in front of her face to remind herself that happiness is always right there, within arm's reach. Funny, this idea that happiness is blue. It's as if she had this thought before. All of a sudden, the wind sets up a high-pitched whistling and rushes in through the window. Maple twigs catch at Julia's dress and scratch her skin. The sky has gone dark. Julia shivers. The air smells humid. The next moment, a flash of lightning rips her painting from top to bottom. The light is blinding. It hurts, as if a razor had slit her retina. A sharp, cracking sound shatters the silence. The tree across the road has been split in two. Its heart is blown open, scorched, but the tree has not caught fire. One of the severed branches dangles dangerously close to the power lines along the avenue. Julia ducks her head back in, pulls the window shut, and turns around, trembling. She scans the room, ready to face whatever might be coming. But everything is in order. Each item sitting silently in its assigned place. Still, her eyes continue flicking back and forth, lingering on dark corners, decoding shadows. Seized by an irrational feeling of panic, she gathers up the dirty clothes piled in the hamper and hurries downstairs to the basement laundry room. She arrives panting. Such a fright for no reason. She shrugs her shoulders. And then she feels the tremors begin. They always start the same way. A tingling in her heels, getting sharper as it travels up her calves, intensifying as it reaches her knees. Julia knows she has only a few minutes before she passes out. She climbs the laundry room steps on all fours and crawls across the kitchen and into the living room. She needs to get into a corner of the room and prop herself up before it's too late. She wedges herself into the corner, sits up straight, legs stretched out in front of her for balance. One brief moment to congratulate herself for reacting in time, and then her world turns upside down. Her inner eye has taken over. She feels herself slipping away. Her gaze clouds over. Her eyes are choked with a thick white mist, and her mind shifts to another place. Julia floats into nothingness. Beyond time and space, she has lost control of her body. She has abandoned it like a lost glove between two walls of her living room. She is familiar with this journey, though she can never predict how long it will last or where it will take her. Julia's not scared anymore. She knows she won't die. She knows she won't suffocate in the white substance enveloping her. She has the gift. She has received instruction She is part of a lineage. All of her energy is being channeled into the connection that is about to take place. Her inner eye will craft itself onto someone else's vision, someone completely unknown to her. Suddenly, Julia finds herself in a dimly lit room, looking through a half-open door. She can see a young woman with her back turned, illuminated in the glare of a neon light. The woman is wearing a skin-tight black dress down to her ankles. Her black hair is pulled back into a perfect chignon, as round and shiny as a pebble. She's carefully applying her makeup. Her graceful neck bent forward to bring her face closer to the mirror covering the wall. The eyes through which Julia is looking trace the young woman's slim figure from the nape of her neck to her heels, lingering on the hollow of her back. Aware she is being watched, the woman turns around. She has oriental eyes and full red lips. They part in a distant and perfect smile. Julia's source is sitting on the edge of a bed. A man. She glimpses his strong knees, realizes he's naked. Her peripheral vision takes in the drawn curtains, a chest of drawers behind the half-open door, articles of clothing thrown carelessly over a chair. The man gets up and walks towards the young woman. Julia sees a small, impersonal bathroom. She recognizes the logo of a large American hotel chain on the damp towels lying on the floor. The young woman holds out a hand in a gesture of affection and finds herself being swept up into a passionate embrace from which she hastily disengages herself, laughing. She spins around, throwing one last look at herself in the mirror, picks up her handbag from beside the wash basin, and walks quickly out of the room, perched confidently on her high heels. The door clicks shut behind her. Julia searches in the shadows for a long moment. Then her field of vision shifts to the left. It travels up the bed and comes to rest on a mobile phone that is buzzing insistently, like a fly on its back. The man ignores it. He lies down and closes his eyes. Julia remains trapped in the dark for some time, helpless, unable to enter the thoughts or dreams of the person she's been twinned with. And then the connection breaks. Julia feels herself being propelled to the surface. She breaks free from the darkness and travels through the milky white haze. Light restores the shapes of objects, signaling the gradual return of her sight. Slowly things come into focus. Her hands are still on her knees. Her body is still wedged into the corner. Only her head has moved. It hangs heavily in front of her. The nape of her neck is sore, the way it always is after one of these journeys. Welcome to Los Angeles.
Thank you.
So well translated. It's so much poetry there. It's so hard to translate all the poetry in there, right?
Yes.
I realize you've been here in Los Angeles before.
Yeah, my son was born here.
Really? Because in this book, there is a picture of you with him in 88.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
In your first memoir, which is also beautifully written. And I said, did he come to Disneyland? No, he's a Los Angelenos.
Yes.
He's an Angeleno.
He was born in San Bernardino.
So my first question is, how do you see your encounter with this city and its people now and back then? What the differences? What where you are now?
Well, it brings lots of emotion. When I was coming and you know, taking the highway, I was thinking, I have been here lots of times doing this road. It hasn't changed much, I think. It's a city that has this happiness in it. I don't know if it's the blue sky without clouds or, but it's amazing. I mean, you feel and the weather. Wow, and the weather.
I'm going to start with the confessions. As an Argentine who went through a lot of the things that Julia went through, like being disappeared, being active in the parents' movement, being a mother back then, very young, being a prisoner in Villa Devoto prison, where Julia, all these things happened to Julia. The other confession is I was not supposed to be here. If you signed up earlier for this program, there was another writer who was supposed to be here, but I call these things magic Marxism. And so now I'm here for some reason. But anyways, I approached your book very scared. I said, well, will she... I know you went through a lot of these things and you're coming from the same place and it's not just a novelist who parachutes on, but why Argentina? Will she be able to not trivialize our experience? Will what she went through help her? And then I found you did a lot of research. There is a lot of history. We can use this book to teach our classes and... Tell us about this research, what took you to Argentina, and this, how do you do your so accurate, so powerful research on our history?
I'm not sure I found Argentina. I think that Argentina found me.
Okay.
And I was completely, seduced and enticed by Argentina. The story, well... You know, this is a novel that has lots of unusual things happening. I mean, you saw what I read is about the gift Julia has. She can see into the future. She can see things that happens to others. She has this premonition and so. This is really something that is very much into the novel. But the reality is that it happened to me when I was writing this. And I'm going to tell you the story because it's how it happened. I was in Oxford writing for my master's in theology. And I was reading on liberation theology, and I found a group of priests called Los Curas del Tercer Mundo, Sacerdotes del Tercer Mundo. And I was fascinated by the idea of this priest, Argentinian all. And so I began searching. I went to, well, in Oxford, there was nothing about them, of course. But I went to Spain to research. And then I found the story of this amazing priest. And I was completely fascinated by his story. His name is Carlos Mujica. I mean, people don't know about him. I think that he should be like with Evita Perón, yeah. Like he's an...
He is in many houses in Argentina.
Yes, I know, in Argentina, but yeah. Not elsewhere. No. And I thought this is something that people should know. Mm-hmm. This guy was a Hollywood actor. He was so handsome. And then he came from this family with everything, power, wealth, clout, everything. And he abandons all he has. And he decides that he's going to fight and devote his life for the destitutes in Buenos Aires. So I was, you know, with the idea of thinking, wow, I would like to write a novel. I was very, you know, clear that my next book was going to be a novel. And suddenly I thought, but I want this guy to be in the novel. I want to write about this guy, but he's not a fiction character, right? So how do I make this? And I was, you know, puzzled and thinking, how am I going to weave all these ideas? I was in that thought. And I was invited to Australia. Australia, imagine, nothing to do with anything. So here I go in my trip to Australia, and I have 2 days, like in the middle of my tour in Australia, 2 days, like, with nothing to do. So I say, oh, my God, I'm going to check something one of those dreams that I always wanted to do. I'm going to go diving, scuba diving in the coral reef. I needed to do that. So here I go. I take my plane. I arrive to Cairns. And in this beautiful beach, there was no one but me. I'm alone, bathing suit, my little straw hat, thinking, this is heaven. My God, what is this? It's exactly the opposite of the jungle. You know, it was bliss. And suddenly I hear, Ingrid, Ingrid. And I'm like trying to hide. Oh, my God, no. Ingrid, Ingrid. So I won't be hiding much. So I turn around and I see this beautiful woman coming to me. And she says, you're Ingrid, right? Yes. And she says, oh, my God, I read your memoir. Look, I absolutely have to talk to you. Do you have 10 minutes? And I'm like, oh, my God, no.
The last thing you wanted to do is to talk about your memoir.
Oh, my God. And so, but I couldn't say no. I mean, I was in my bathing suit. I was doing nothing. So I said, yes, of course, sit down. Well, this woman was Argentinian. Uh-huh. She was 15 and she was a Montonera. Uh-huh. And she's telling me all this. We're in the beach and she's telling me her story of her life, telling me that she met Carlos Mujica. And I was, what? You met him? Yes. And what happened to you? Oh, I was disappeared and I was tortured. And what? I mean, can you believe? I mean, that's why I'm telling you. I mean, Argentina found me. She was the one founding me. And then I asked her, look, I'm writing this novel. And would you mind if I use your life as, you know, part of the character of the main character of my novel? Well, she was the one opening. I mean, the story of Julia is the story of Liliana. She was the one opening to me all this. I mean, this information, the world, of course, her own experience. But then I could read lots of testimonies, and then I did lots of research. And it was kind of, you know, because the novel I wanted to write was a novel that you could read, you know, on a beach in holidays. And then I was with this baby on. And it was, I mean... So this is a novel that it's like a milkshake. It has lots of things.
That's true. Yeah. A lot of levels. Yes. I mean, because one of the things is, and that's what, when men who went through all these experiences write, they tend to write about the history. Now you have the balance of the history, all the context, and the poetry and the story of Julia. I couldn't help but noticing that Julia's mother, grandmother, Mama Fina, is very light-skinned, almost transparent. And, of course, there is a conversation, I think, with House of Spirits, you know, Isabel Allende's family of women with Clara, Alba, all these clear names and this ability to see. But you, it's not just a coincidence, but the way you, or is it? But the way you make them more empowered, because they
strong
see
women.
And they can change.
Yes, they can change it. And actually, for Julia, as for her grandmother, the gift is not something that is just like, you know, something that is there. It's like a responsibility, it's a vocation. Her gift is, she understands that what she has to be used to serve others. So Julia, and that's, for me, it's one of the most important thing in life. I mean, I portrayed in Julia, but in life, is that really you become adult, or if you wish, spiritually mature, when you are able to come out of your self-centeredness and you devote your life to the others. When you do that shift, when your gaze, when your eyes are on the other and not on yourself, that's when the light really shines. I mean, we are people of relationship. Humans are not, we're not individuals like lost in our little bubble of ourselves. We grow in contact with the others. And we can survive thanks to the others. And the others are not only the presence, the physical presence, the others, and I know that everyone in this room will understand what I'm saying, that we live with the words we have inherited of the people we love. And when those people are not there anymore, physically present, those words inhabit in us. And those words convey the energy of love that allows us to just be strong even when we are so frail.
That's true. That's true. Although I feel that's a bit of a joke, my magic Marxism thing, but it's like the spirits of my compañeros, the ones who did not survive, whenever I can bring them back, and you gave me a greatest excuse to talk about the need for justice and all this. Changes that are happening in Argentina that are very unsettling now. But to continue with my confessions, there is a reviewer, Amy Gentry, in reviewed the book for the Chicago Tribune, and she says that the best parts are the torture parts. And so she says, it's a little bit difficult to say this, but this is the best written part. These are the best written parts of the book. And so I must confess that I skipped those, because the same way that I, when my husband is watching Law and Order and I sit there and special, you know, yeah, what is a special crimes unit? I cover my eyes when torture end happens. But how was the process of, because you went through torture. And so this process of writing about it, going back to that place of...
Well, I have to say that I was not tortured like you were. I mean, I wasn't subject to systematic torture. I was abused. I was subject to violence. What I think is that human pain is what we have in common. I mean, we can relate to the pain of others through the pain we have suffered. And when I was reading the testimonies of everything that happened in Argentina in those years, for me it was like if it was my own experience, I mean physically, I could absolutely understand what they were talking about. And it's true that I wrote this without gloves, if you wish.
Like we say, without gloves.
I went deep into it, mm-hmm. because, you see, I think that, of course, this is fiction, right? This is a novel of fiction. Julia doesn't exist and Theo doesn't exist, but they exist in a way. And through them, I think it was important to honor those who cannot talk, your friends, people. Also, I mean, I think that suffering has been aestheticized in a way. You know, we are in a world where movies, where the internet makes us feel that suffering is something that is like unreal, like a game, yeah. You know. And writing is what gives you the connection from inside. Then when you're looking at a movie, you can be away, you can take your distance. But when you're reading, you cannot. You're plugged. If you're plugged, you're really plugged. And when you're in a novel, you're reading like if it was you. You are the one living. You are the one feeling the emotions. You are driven by what you're reading, and you are embodying it. And it happens to me when I read novels, I have to stop. I have to go and drink. I have emotions, and I'm just reading. So this is why I thought that even if this was a fantasy, and I really wanted to be a fantasy, and there's magic in it, there are things, and the characters are, you know, are epic in the sense that they are doing incredible things, but I wanted to just get to the core of the suffering. Because I think we owe them that. I mean, if we cannot bring justice...
Vulnerability, right?
Yes.
That vulnerability.
Yes. Yeah. And also because, you know, I think that... Well, that's how I see history. We never know what will happen to us. I was taken in captivity thinking that it would never happen to me. And it happened. And I think that when you go through these things... you have to share with people your experience in order for them to be prepared. Because we never know. And I can tell you that books that I read before my abduction, like the books of Primo Levi or things of Auschwitz, it helped me a lot in understanding the risk of losing my identity, of losing my soul. And this book yeah. is about that. This book is about the choices you make. When, you know, what is freedom?
It's fascinating because Ariel Dorfman, Death and the Maiden. I don't know if you're familiar with the script and the movie and the play. Both Glenn Close and Sigourney Weaver, when they played the character of Paulina, they met with me, and they met with a friend of mine, Veronica De Negri, who was tortured by doctors in Chile. And we both said, oh, we don't want to be in the credits of this Roman Polanski movie. We want to help Sigourney Weaver. But in a way, people are going to see your novel as the opposite, because in Death and the Maiden, the character, the woman, is filled with rage and revenge. And the man is a lawyer who talks sense to her. And she, for those of you who probably everybody has seen that movie, I don't know why, I think, but she is a former torture victim in Chile during the dictatorship who manages to capture the doctor just because he has a flat in front of a flat tire in front of her house, and the doctor who participated in her torture, and she interrogates him, and the husband is a lawyer in, with a commission to investigate disappearances in Chile, and he doesn't believe her. So I don't know if this Julia is totally different to this Paulina built by Ariel Dorfman and the man too, right?
You know, I think that, well, in the novel there are two characters. Julia, which has this gift. She's into the future. So she's always looking forward and she's always wanting to go forward and she's embracing life and she's a strong woman. She knows that she's frail, but because she knows she's frail, then she's strong. And then she loves, and that's the power in her life. Then there's Theo. And what I wanted to show is how in front of the same event, they lived exactly the same thing, same tortures with the same man, the same thing, how you choose in the our freedom mm-hmm. is to choose how we act and react in front of events we cannot change. And so Theo, he will be completely chained to his thirst of revenge, to the past. He cannot forgive. But he cannot forgive because he cannot forgive himself. He wanted to be this hero, this leader of the Montoneros, and he wanted to, you know, free his country from the dictatorship and everything. And then, under torture, he is just like you and me. You know, I mean, he suffers. And when it's done, he can't cope with it. But the truth about what I wrote is that we are all Theos and Julias. Julia and Theo are inside of us. There's always this propension to just not let go, to dwell in our suffering, in our pain, and to seek revenge, and that's a prison. And then you have the other side, the light side of each of us, which is the one, I mean, wanting to find in forgiveness a way through the suffering, a way out, to escape the madness of what humans we can do. So I think that we always have the power to choose. Theo chose what he wanted, and Julia chose too. And in a way, even if Theo seems to be the darkest soul of the two, the way he's going to resolve his equation is a way of resolving it through love and through self-sacrifice. And in a way, to not become like the ones who tortured him. And I think it's beautiful. I mean, of course, if you see both, I remember when my son read the novel, he said, oh, Julia doesn't exist. She's a superwoman. I mean, it's impossible. I like Theo because Theo is real. You know. And then I was telling him, no, I mean, Julia, I mean, she's struggling with her pain. And Theo too. And that's how we are. And that's who we are. And the decisions we take on how we deal with those moments is our identity. And I say this, and I insist, because this is in history. But take it out of history. Bring it to your normal life, okay? And think about those moments, normally with the people we love the most. They are the ones who push our buttons. And you will see how strange it is that we reenact the same dialogues on and on and on. Like if we didn't know better. I mean, we know that if we say this, the other will react this way. And then we will react this way. And then it will become a big problem, right? The thing is that if we know that we have the power inside of ourselves to choose how to react or how to act, how to not talk sometimes, how to just, you know, this time I'm going to try this other way of responding. And we can just, you know, try to see if we can just overcome those kind of walls that we build in the relationship we have with people we love. And that's freedom. Freedom is about constructing relationship with others that bring the best in ourselves and in the other.
And the solidarity, right?
Your compassion.
Yeah. When taking this, you said choose to not to talk, right? And when justice, you know, this book, The Little School, was used as evidence in the trials against the genocide perpetrators in Argentina, and my moment of glory was when this thing that I thought I was just writing was an instrument for justice, right? And then I decided for a whole year I wouldn't talk, because I said, okay, people are now talking. People are testifying. People are seeing that Theo is not failing himself. Theo was tortured into that, into his, you know, it's not his fault. It's the torturer's fault. It's the genocide perpetrator's fault. And recently I was reading an interview in 2014, you said they were asking you if you were going to go back into the political life because, I mean, you're a congresswoman running for president, senator, your whole family. And you said, no, something, this paper in Colombia, maybe they are misquoting you, but you said, por ahora me siento muy tranquila porque veo que los que están allá lo están haciendo muy bien. Entonces no me siento para nada necesaria y por eso puedo dormir tranquila. I'm relaxed now. The people who are in the country are doing things really well there, and I'm not so necessary there. And do you still think that way, or is this totally misquoting you?
No, it's really what I think. I think that there are times for everything. There are times to be vocal. There are times to be silent. There are times to act. There are times to just be passive. I think that we have to be very cautious on not letting ourselves get pulled by the desires of others. You know, when I came back from captivity, everybody wanted me to be back in politics. I had another agenda. My agenda was to be a mother. I hadn't been a mother for 7 years. My children had grown up. I didn't know who they were. And in the jungle, when I was recapping all my life, I was thinking, if I lose politics, who cares? If I lose my marriage, I'll be sad, but I mean, I can get over. But I will never get over the fact of not being the mother of my children. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that I love profoundly in my life. And then I was thinking, in all those years, my family was not my priority. My Colombia was my priority. I did everything for my dreams. Well, when I'll be out, my priority will be my family. And I'm so glad I did that. Yeah.
You know,
so
it's the
now I could now say, well, yeah. Back to battle.
Back to battle. They might talk
you
to that. You never know.
But I'm very happy writing. I have to confess that it has been, writing has been amazing. It's really, it's a pleasure.
When you're writing, I mean, it took me a long, long time to go back to the letters I had sent my daughter from prison with the poems and the stories. And I know you have a book with the letters to your mom from the jungle. It's not in English. Will we ever
see it?
It is in English.
That is to my mom, yes. It's one letter.
Oh.
The only letter that made it through the jungle. I was very ill, very, very ill. And the commander came and said to me, I have very good news for you. You're going to be able to send a message to your mother because we're going to videotape you. And we're going to make a proof of survival. And I thought, no way. I don't want people to see me like this. Not my children, I mean. And I don't want to be used by these guys just to, what, proof of life so that we stay here 10 more years? No way. So I and they were, you know, he was very pushy. And I said, look, the only thing that I accept to do is to write a letter to my mother. If you promise me that it will get to my mother. He said, okay. So they brought paper, they brought a pen. I wrote from 8 a.m. in the morning till 4, the whole day of light. It was, of course, daylight. I wrote with all my heart, and it was a testament because I was not sure I was going to make it through. Well, this commander put the letter in his pocket and then took a video camera and said, and now we're going to videotape you. And I said, no. And he said, yes. So I feel betrayed. I mean, it was a very horrible moment. You know, that moment was one of those moments of, you know, when I thought, I'm going to kill this guy. I've never had this thirst of blood as I had that moment.
Well, your letter was hostage.
Yeah, but that
like
was
you were
that was after the letter. The letter didn't have that anger because the anger was.
What is he gonna do with this letter?
Yes.
Now he's gonna use me, and he just.
But the point where I'm getting is that when I was going through that intense feeling, it scared me. I thought, oh my God, I don't want to be a murderer. I don't want to be like them. I'm not going to hate them. I'm going to work my way out of this psychological prison. Mm. And the day I'll be out, I'll be free from this feeling of wanting to kill them. So it's a long journey. That's Julia's journey.
Yeah, that's true. Ingrid, we how many writers in the audience? There's this belief, a bunch. Many teachers, professors who are going to be teaching this book, which is great, too. We're very close to Hollywood. And writers in LA, we think, I don't know if it's a myth, but we think that when big mainstream publishers publish a novel, it's because they see potential for a movie there. And you have had this experience with a video camera that you didn't treasure particularly, but also some documentaries were done. And if a movie, how would you feel?
I would love it. I would love it. In fact, because, you know, when I read novels, for me it's movies, best than movies, because the movie's in my head, so I'm just imagining everything. And what I like in a novel is the fast pace, and then it's the epic thing, like a whole life, and then the thriller, like chasing something, having to discover a mystery or something like this. And that's what I wanted to do with the Blue Line. So when I was writing it, I really was seeing the things, I mean, my characters, and it really is a movie novel, in a way.
Mm-hmm. No, that's...
Yeah.
Because thriller, right? Yeah, I mean, thriller. There is the history. But because there were a couple of bad experiences with movies, Imagine in Argentina, even with Banderas, so charming. But it was an awful movie. The novel was really pretty okay, but the movie was... And then... Of Love and Shadow, again, Banderas. Okay, so try not to get Banderas.
Okay.
So this is the last question, and then after that we'll go to a Q&A. So I remember one day, many years ago, I was interviewing Julia Alvarez. Julia Alvarez, a Dominican writer. She had just published When the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent, and I had not published anything, and we were in front of an audience. And then I say, well, do you want to ask her a question? And a woman raised her hand, and she says, I want her to read more. And I was like destroyed. I mean, I was having this amazing conversation with this writer. I was learning a lot about the craft, and they just wanted her to read. But I don't want this to happen to me again. So the Blue Line starts with nature, with trees, with winds, right? You heard the beginning of the novel. And the protagonist lives now in Connecticut. The year is 2006. Yet when we have read Even Silence Has an End, the memory, that scene sends us back to your time in captivity in the jungle. It seems to be like a bridge between these two works. And also you're reflecting there in that same page 385, for those who want to quote it in the novel. And I could to ask you to read a bit from Even Silence Has an End. And also, you are reflecting about the act of writing here, right? And any portion of the Blue Line among the writing that you had to destroy a lot of your writing while you were in the jungle.
Yeah.
So could you tell us if that is...
Okay. But like everything I wrote in the jungle, I burned it to avoid it falling into the wrong hands. I was thinking about all this, sitting in my caleta, planning my French lessons for the next day, when I suddenly heard a long, creaking sound. It was painful. Horrible, the way it echoed, as if it were increasing in volume to surprise us and oblige us to look up. I saw a rustling of leaves over by the chontos. The chontos is how the guerrillas would call the bathrooms, which were not bathrooms, of course, but the place where we would go, that was the chontos. And then I saw Tiger dash hell-bent for leather through the camp, abandoning his guard post. The tallest tree in the forest had chosen that particular moment to die, and it had come crashing down like a felled giant. Our surprise was equal to that of the young trees it brought down with it, which smashed with a thundering sound as they landed on the ground, raising a huge cloud of dust in the blast generated by the fall. Parrots flew away, terrified. My hair was swept backwards by the shockwave. My face was coated with a cloud of particles that covered all the tents and the surrounding foliage. The sky had opened, revealing frayed yellow clouds. Everyone ran to take shelter. It didn't even occur to me to do so. You know, when I was in the jungle, and when I wrote this blue line too, I was thinking of something. When I was at school in France, we used to read a poem of Baudelaire. It's called Correspondance. I'm sure the translation exists. It's a beautiful poem. Baudelaire is one of my favorite authors, the best poet, one of the best poets, with Neruda. you don't like Neruda?
Vallejo.
Well, yeah. I love Neruda. I love Neruda. And his idea was, and I made it mine, that we have this link with nature, that when we see things happening in nature, we see them through the eyes of our emotions. So whatever happens in nature, we describe it in our words, which is a way of depicting what is going inside of our hearts. So rain could be a way of expressing the melancholy of loneliness, for example. There's a beautiful poem in French. Il pleut sur mon cœur comme il pleut sur la ville. Quelle est cette langueur qui pénètre mon cœur? Au bruit doux de la pluie, par terre et sur les toits, pour un cœur qui s'ennuie, oh, le chant de la pluie. Beautiful.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
But the thing is that we decode nature like a mirror to decode ourselves. And that's what happens in the blue line. That's also what, and in the blue line, this the moment where the tree is cut in half by the lightning. Well, it's the premonition of how Julia's heart is going to be broken with what she will see in her with her gift. And that's the novel, so I won't tell you.
No, spoiler alert. Thanks a lot, but we'll have questions and...
Thank you so much, Alicia.
Thank you.
I have to tell you that for me, it's an honor to have you here with me. I mean, it's an honor. Because you see, this is the living proof that love and light is bigger and stronger than hate and darkness.
Thank you. Thanks so much. So people have questions, right?
I'm wondering whether it's possible to be tortured and not be broken. And if you're broken, how do you put yourself together again?
Is it a question for Alicia or for me?
It's a question for both of you.
We don't have recipes for survivor. For survival, right? People are people, and many people are broken, and that's why we need to stop torture, right? Your work you're doing, organizing, the work we are doing with Amnesty International, the work we are doing is to stop it. Because, I mean, I'm not an expert on the consequences, just one person, and each of us is one person who goes through things. Okay, we have some running part.
I apologize for my ignorance of Argentinian politics, but I think one of the two of you said earlier that the situation in Argentina was troubling or something, or worrying, and I wondered if this political situation there was troubling or promising or somewhere in between.
Again, for Alicia.
Okay, well, it's troubling now. We have had elections, a new president barely 2 months ago who is acting with some kind of revenge against all what people were building in terms of memory. Then closing the offices of support for the survivors who were testifying in court. I mean, he is, aside from his economic and political position, the country is split into on this vote. And his position is neoliberal. He comes with an agenda to somehow destroy a lot of what we have been building in terms of justice in Argentina, which is unprecedented, I guess, in all over Latin America, the amount of reparation we have achieved. I mean, people listen to us. The NPR, I was listening to your NPR interview the other day, which was very, very moving. And the journalist, you are saying you are ignorant, but the journalist was saying that millions of people in Argentina deny what happened, and Julia knows. Well, they denied back then, but we have gone through years and years of trials, and the perpetrators have been are in jail, and people and survivors are getting some kind of reparation. So, but that is being reverted now. But it's not my show. It's yours. Ask her a question for her.
But before there is another question, I would like to answer yours. Because because the way I see the way we get out of the nightmare of human horror is by understanding that that human horror is not in the other. It's not the other. It's in ourselves. I mean, each of us here, we could be a horrible person and a monster and a torturer, even though if we think that it would never occur to us. But the fact is that I have seen it. I mean, I have seen good people turning into very bad people. I mean, sadistic and violent. The way this happens is always linked to rational. It's a very perverse rational. But once you give yourself reasons to justify the harm you can do to another person, then when that rational gets into you, then you think you are the good person doing what you're doing. And that explains everything in history. And it also explains family violence. That's why I think if the suffering of some can be useful for others, it's by understanding that this is things that are human. It's our humanity that is at stake. And we have to prevent that in, I think that it begins with our children. I mean, it begins in nurturing the compassion, the goodness, the respect. And we have to do it not with big discourses and, you know, but we do it with our kindness, with our tenderness, with the way we act, with the words we use. We can be a loving person, but if we are harsh with our words, we're going to break someone's souls. So I think that the way you recover from those bad experiences is by sharing them with others so that it doesn't happen again.
This is related to that question, but thinking, the two of you, I know, have done a lot of thinking about forgiveness, which is a very complicated transaction. And we had it here at Aloud a number of years ago, Phumla Gobodo-Madikizela, who was on the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and she interviewed one of the perpetrators. And she talked about how you need the acknowledgement by the perpetrator. It's part of the process of reconciliation or of forgiveness. And I wondered if you could speak to that a little bit, or any observations, because I don't know if you were able to receive that in any way. I kind of doubt it from those who had done these things to you.
Well, in Colombia, there is a peace process today, and it's incredible, because 5 years ago in Colombia, there was no way people would try even, to see the other, the FARC, like, with any kind of, like a human being. It was just terrorist. It was a horror. But the country has been transforming itself. And when I say the country, I say everyone. And you see, the incredible thing about forgiving is that it plays in two ways. I mean, when you first you forgive because you need to breathe. If you don't forgive, you're caught in your past and you cannot even move. So you have to just leave it behind, and said intellectually, rationally, you decide that you're going to forgive in order to be free of the pain and the bitterness and everything. But as you do, in a way, you are giving to the one that harmed you an open door to become again a human. And it affects both ways. I think that forgiveness is one of the most incredible and powerful actions that we have as humans to transform the relationship between people that have problems. I mean, of course, in a civil war like in Colombia or Argentina. And I want to say something about Argentina that has always impacted me. You know that in Argentina, with all the suffering, I might be wrong, but I don't know cases of people wanting to take revenge by their own.
No, they're not in Chile. They're not. So that's why
it goes through justice.
Your novel is refreshing in that sense. That is not this character that actually enacts.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to spoiler alert. No, but yeah, I'm coming from a different place because I'm not a Catholic. And although I always say I'm an atheist Jew with deep roots in liberation theology, so that's why I feel so close to Mujica and all that. But for me, justice is what does it. And it's a different situation. And your question, they have not acknowledged what they have done. They justify the torture, they justify the killings, they keep this discourse that it was necessary to save the country. So it's a different situation.
No, in Colombia, it's amazing, actually. When I'm telling you this, I'm just in awe, because I have a very difficult relationship with Colombia, of course. But there is an individual and collective spiritual transformation, in the sense that, this is amazing. You have the leaders of the FARC acknowledging the damage they did and wanting to talk to the victims in order to ask for forgiveness. But not only that, the military are too thinking there is something that happened when suddenly they understood that both were victims and torturers at the same time. And when it happened, then they began to talk like acknowledging what had happened. It was not pointing fingers. It was just, you know, and this is, for me, it's, of course, the situation in Colombia has been different. Mm-hmm. Because it's not something that has been like integrated into some kind of political necessity. It has been a family torn apart with by ideology. And I think that now, I mean, when I say this, believe me that in Colombia, like in Argentina, the country is divided. There are those who have lots of trouble with the peace process and those who are completely hoping and supporting the peace process. But in the midst of all the confusion and all the things, I can see how people have been changing in even the guerrilleros, the way they express themselves, the words they use. It's a different tuning. So the 23rd of March, Colombia should be signing the peace agreement. And let's hope that nothing will interfere, because I'm really, really wanting that to happen.
That's a great note to end this conversation, right? Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.